And to discuss that first, that last story there about Network Rail, I'm joined by Bruce Williamson, and he's from Rail Futures. Hi, Bruce. Welcome to the Politics.
Hello.
Now, you've done a bit of media on this week, haven't you? National media.
It's been a very busy week for us, actually. Yeah, I did two interviews. Well, anyway, the media's gone wild.
Okay,
very, very interested in this story.
So,
yeah.
Okay, so what's the justification we're getting from the government about why they should be selling off the rail tracks?
Well, and they're not quite selling off the rail track. That's not entirely true. But the justification is this. You have an organisation, Network Rail, which manages the tracks. We all know that. And we have the train operating companies that run the trains on those tracks.
And we got in the middle in the sandwich, you've got
the Roscoes, yeah.
And now Roscoe stands for?
Rolling Stock Company. So a lot of people don't know this, that First Great Western or Southern or whoever don't actually own the trains that they run under their own livery on their franchise.
And what's the logic behind that?
The logic is this, that if, let's say, First Great Western owned the trains and First Great Western lost the franchise, they would still own the trains, and they would have the next franchisee over a barrel, because they'd say, well, we've got the trains that run this line, you know, pay us £10 million apiece, you know, when they're only worth three, or whatever, I don't know. So they have to separate out, you know, the ownership of the trains from the operation of the trains for that reason. So you have the rolling stock companies, Network Rail, and the train operating companies themselves that actually, you know, they have very little room for manoeuvre, the train operating companies.
Now, I was just looking at the companies that actually own the rolling stock. Mm. A lot of them actually, I mean, for a long time, one of them was just simply wholly owned by HSBC Bank.
Yes.
I mean, they're not necessarily some guy sitting in his shed who's done loads of work and he's managed to do this. No, it is actually just big financial institutions have decided they can make a lot of money doing this.
Indeed, and they did, especially I think in the early days of rail privatisation. I think that's one of the reasons why it's controversial.
So they used a holding company. I think that's what they did. They basically created a new company, bought all the shares in that, controlled that, and it just had a different name. So
yeah.
Anyway.
So you've got this sort of fragmentation, and it would make sense, wouldn't it, that you integrate the track and the train, because obviously they naturally go hand in hand. And the idea is that the train operating companies know what happens on their patch. You know, they're the sort of, if you like, the regional or the local experts. They know what the priorities are, what the bottlenecks are, where there are problems on their bits of track. And so the idea is, if you sort of devolve control of your own bit of track to the train operating companies, then it might result in a little bit more efficiency and a little bit more smoother running of the railways.
Well, that would all be very well if the train operating companies were working efficiently. As we heard at Prime Minister's Questions this week, they're not necessarily, even though Peter Bottomley wanted to say that actually Southern Rail were in the right to get rid of guards. But anyway, let's have a quick listen to that clip.
Sir Peter Bottomley!
Perhaps thinking of rail passengers trying to get to their jobs, the General Secretary of the TUC spoke about shafted and abandoned workers, while the Unite Union's Len McCluskey is doing a UKIP dance move, resigning before trying to return. Will my right honourable friend encourage union and other political leaders to tell the RMT that 250 people with guaranteed employment should not bring the lives, the jobs and the safety of 600,000 Southern Rail passengers at risk?
Mr. Speaker, I'm sure that my honourable friend will be speaking on behalf of many thousands of rail passengers in his constituency and many others in the south of England. And it's deeply disappointing that some unions are threatening to strike over the Christmas period. The government is now investing record amounts in improving our railways, up to £40 billion over the next 5 years, and we need everyone in industry, both management and unions, to work together to secure the best deal for passengers. I have to say that the RMT's action shows coordinated contempt for the travelling public, and it seems designed to do nothing except bring about the maximum damage to people's lives. Mr. Speaker, there is some heckling from the benches opposite. This party, Mr. Speaker, is on the side of rail passengers.
Yeah!
And I hope that the party opposite will join me in saying to the rail union leaders, sort it out, put the travelling public first, stop the squabbling and tell your members to get back to work.
Well, the view we didn't get there was that from Sadiq Khan, the London Mayor. He's saying the government is abandoning passengers on Southern Rail. So things aren't all rosy with the train operating companies, are they, Bruce?
No, They certainly aren't. And Southern is very much the villain of the piece at the moment, and for a number of reasons. But, you know, as you might expect, it's very much a sort of mixed bag, you know. What's notable, of course, as you're probably aware, that many of the train operating companies are owned by the state-owned railway companies of other European countries, such as, you know, the Netherlands and France and Germany. So we have this bizarre situation where our privatised railway is being run by the state-owned railways of other countries. It's quite funny, really, isn't it?
There's some logic behind it. Do you think that that's reasonable, or is this just what I said at the top of the hour, which is selling off to your mates more things to sell off? We've got some assets here.
Not actually being sold off, are they? It's about management. You know, the ownership of the track will remain within Network Rail. It's the maintenance and running of it. But of course, it's a mixed blessing. So on the one hand, you get this supposed advantage, which may indeed be an advantage, that you've got integration of track and train locally, so that everything's working together. But the other danger, well, there's two dangers that I see. Firstly, is that you're fragmenting Network Rail, because quite obviously you've got a sort of knowledge base of expertise within Network Rail and some sort of, you know, very expensive specialised capital equipment and so on. And for a sort of an operation like Network Rail, it makes sense to have it operating as a whole. And the second concern is that you are simply introducing another layer of bureaucracy to the running of the railways, and Lord knows there are already enough layers of bureaucracy in running.
Well, there's another side to this, isn't it? Because one of the things I've noticed that quite often train operating companies, they don't actually have enough carriages on a specific train. So what they'll do is they'll say, well, we think that this is the minimum number of carriages we need to run this service, and even if people have to sort of sit in the aisles and they're not actually going to get a seat, that's okay because it's cheaper for us. So they're cutting costs by doing that right across the country. I mean, in fact, there was a whole sort of spat, wasn't there, with Jeremy Corbyn a few months ago?
Yes,
about
indeed,
him sitting on a train.
Yeah.
You don't want to sit on the floor, you want a seat. And the train operating companies aren't interested.
No, that's not true. I mean, it is true that there aren't enough carriages to go around and people have to sit on the floor.
But don't they do that on purpose?
No, they don't have to pay so much. No, not at all. This is all very much in the control of government. And it's going back to what I was saying about the train operating companies being micromanaged by the government, the Department for Transport. The train operating companies don't get to choose which trains they run.
How long they are?
They don't have enough. That's the whole point. When you see a train that is too short, and the obvious question is, well, why don't they just put on an extra carriage? The answer is, they don't have
one. So whose responsibility is it to actually maintain these trains? Surely it's
the maintenance.
Owners.
Yeah, the maintenance is done
by private companies.
Yeah, but the ownership and the allocation of rolling stock is managed centrally by the Department for Transport. And there's a desperate shortage of rolling stock right across the network. And this is another reason why, you know, you have this separation of ownership of the trains and the operation of them, is because when you want to buy some more trains, you have to make a big order. You know, I can't just go and buy another Intercity 125 now, because they don't make them anymore, for the same reason that I can't go and buy a Ford Sierra, you know. Whereas if I went to Ford and I said, I want 10,000 Ford Sierras, they might reopen the production line. So the government has to manage the purchasing of these large orders of rolling stock, and then they allocate them through the Roscoes to the different train operating companies. So the government is very much in control here, and the poor old train operating companies have very little room for manoeuvre.
Also, with First Great Western, I mean, they're our local franchise, backwards and forwards to Paddington, the main operator that people will be using from Temple Meads, etc. Looking back at their past, First Group have got a massive debt that they're having to service in the United States. In fact, they nearly went bust 3 or 4 years ago, completely bust. In other words, so, you know, that would have been extremely embarrassing, but they managed to refinance, and some jiggling around was done, and a little bit lower interest rates were paid. So it is a little little bit galling, isn't it, to know that when you're buying your train ticket, actually most of it is just going to a bank in America somewhere to service a loan.
Well, I don't think you know, most of it is. It's an argument, obviously, against the privatisation of the railways, that the train operating companies have to take a profit. But to be fair to them, the level of profit is actually very small. You know, it's typically about 3%, whereas most capitalism, you look for a return of about 5% or more. So they're operating a fairly tight ship.
Because isn't it? I mean, I remember reading that what they do when they bid for these contracts is they often bid underneath what they know it's going to cost them, knowing that at least for a few years they'll be able to make some money, and then maybe they'll fold in some way, or maybe pull out of the contract before it comes to its end. The main thing is to win the contract. All eyes are focused on that.
Well, I'm not sure that's true either. I mean, you're right that there have been examples recently of franchisees folding on the East Coast Main Line, but the vast majority of franchises have run their course, and, you know, they're quite fiercely fought after by various different companies who are all making goods.
You mentioned the East Coast Main Line, because this is a perfect example, isn't it? Delivered scores of millions of pounds to the Exchequer, and also delivered the best public service anywhere in the country when it was nationalised in government hands.
Yeah.
Now, of course, it's not anymore, and the figures are starting to return to normal. In other words, overcrowded trains, dissatisfied customers, far less money actually coming into the Exchequer.
Yeah, I don't know what the exact figures are. I mean, you're right that I think that the temporarily nationalised East Coast Main Line was a success, and probably for ideological reasons, the government decided to reprivatise it. But don't forget that, you know, many of the privatised rail companies on the profitable lines are paying huge premiums to the government as well. It's not a one-way street. And overall, the running of trains as a business, if you like, costs nothing to the taxpayer, so it is in a colloquial term washing its own face.
Okay.
Some lines need subsidy, some lines make a huge profit.
They do, and one of the other things they do on these huge profit making lines like the London Bristol to London Paddington is they squeeze everybody in, don't they? You used to have lovely kind of comfy seats where you could stretch your feet out. Now it's like you're on a cattle truck.
Well, I mean, I agree it's a problem, and
even that cattle truck is overcrowded.
Yeah, but hang on, what do you do if you're First Great Western? As I've said before, they don't have any extra trains. They just can't put on any more. They can't lengthen the trains. So they have to find a way of squeezing in more passengers. But I mean, it's symptomatic. And again, you know, it goes back to the government. It's symptomatic of decades of underinvestment in the railways. And we've had for the last 20 years, rail passenger numbers have doubled. On the railways, double. That's quite something, you know. And we certainly don't have anywhere near twice as many trains, or twice as many lines, or twice as many stations. And so, you know, we are concerned that the investment hasn't kept up. I mean, there is some very, very welcome investment going on now, although, you know, I'm very concerned that the investment of electrification on the Great Western seems to have been paused and stopped at Chippenham,
That's quite good, isn't it?
Investment is good, but the fact it stopped is worrying.
This is a sort of mini HS2 they're doing on the London to Paddington, the idea of electrifying it. The idea really being that some nice little companies who are quite cosy with the Department of Transport are going to get these lovely maintenance contracts, and every time one of those little wires goes a little bit skewy, they're going to make a fortune out of it. There's going to be massive amounts of money spent on maintaining the overhead lines.
No, I'm afraid I can't agree at all. That really is a barking mad conspiracy theory. Electrification, firstly, is something we've been pushing for a long, long time, and electrification results in, you know, a faster railway, a more reliable railway. Overhead lines are more reliable than diesel engines. They're cheaper to run, they're cheaper to buy. There's all the green advantages you get from electrification as well.
Well, you're just shoving the pollution somewhere else.
You are shoving the pollution somewhere else, but it's overall still much more efficient.
Nuclear waste driving your train rather than diesel.
Run, but it can be run by wind, it can be run by hydro, it can be run by solar. The point is the pollution coming out of your power station is a lot less than the pollution that would be coming straight out of your diesel exhaust on the train.
Is it more than the car if all those people were in their cars?
It's probably a lot less than if those people were in their cars. You know, rail.
Thank you for making my point for me.
No, but your point was that you're just transferring the pollution. I'm saying that electrifying the railways reduces pollution overall. And I've lost the thread of where I was going to say something else as well. But your next question, please.
Sorry. Well, I mean, I just think that that it's actually quite good that they're not doing that. It just seems to me you keep it simple. You know, this is the way you do run any business. And once you've got whatever it is, 100 miles, 120, whatever it is, into Cardiff of all this extra superstructure over the top of the train, you may well actually end up getting more delays and certainly vast amounts more spent on keeping the rail track up to scratch.
No, again, I disagree that the maintenance cost is actually relatively low. Overall, it's cheaper to run. I mean, certainly the implementation of electrification, as we've seen, is very disruptive. And sadly, those overhead lines aren't pretty, but the pain is definitely worth it for the gain.
The long and the short is, really, it's about, actually, I can go in the car cheaper than I can go on the train.
Yeah, sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. I mean, if you're a regular commuter, I mean, people sort of wince at the cost of season tickets, but on a per journey
70
basis,
70 quid to London, isn't it?
Hang on,
on the train.
Yeah, it can be. It depends when you go.
Basically, that's a day return, isn't it? With a bit of underground as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I agree that rail is too expensive. You know, it's one of the things we're Rail Future campaign for is cheaper fares. But you know, nonetheless, we still want to encourage people to use the trains. And it seems that despite the government's best efforts to price people off with their rail tickets, people are still using the trains in ever-increasing numbers.
If it's one person, you're having to pay 75 quid to go to London and back. I mean, if you've got two or three people going with you, kids in the car, where it's a no-brainer, there's no way you're going to go on the train.
I agree. But your point is what? I mean, like I say, the railways are still...
How are we going to turn that around?
The
idea is you don't want to, because we've already got too many people on the trains.
Well, part of it is all down to investment. Again, you continue the long-term investment. What's really bad for the railways is feast and famine, and that's what we have had in the past and what we're having now with this pause, this interruption to the Great Western electrification, which is, you know, it's a major concern. But if you have that long-term investment and you commit to it in the very long term, then you will have enough trains to deal with the overcrowding, and then you can start to address, well, you can do it simultaneously. You can address the issue of the cost of rail travel, but the government has a very deliberate policy of shifting the cost of running the railways from the taxpayer onto the passenger, and you know, it's a political thing, but whilst it's sort of still not deterring passengers, I suppose it's whilst it's painful for the passengers, the railway itself is still a huge success.
Okay, well, Bruce Williamson from Rail Futures, thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show. And Martin Summers, would you want to put your two apence in here?
Well, obviously, I was opposed to rail privatisation in the first place. So when you're talking about getting these companies back onto the board of Network Rail, it's like reinventing British Rail by the back door in a way. Although, of course, they're fragmenting the network. One of the things that when you were talking about electrification, I was thinking about the Chinese and are talking about doing maglev trains right across the whole of Central Asia. Do we need to think even bigger than just electrification? I mean, one of the problems with our track is it's too narrow, isn't it? I mean, if we'd had a 5 meter gauge or whatever, which Brunel originally wanted, then we would have been in a different position than the one we're in now, because of all the infrastructure. I mean, so, you know, if the station's only that long, it doesn't matter if you put an extra carriage on, because you can't get anybody on the train anyway.
So yeah, there's a number of points here I will pick up. Yeah, there's maglev, I think, is a little bit of a rich man's toy. You know, it's hideously expensive.
What, like HS2 then?
No, it's not.
HS2.
We'll save HS2 for another program, because there's an awful lot I could say about that. But the point is, the fastest maglev trains in the world are only about 5 miles an hour faster than the fastest conventional trains. And they're hideously expensive and hideously thirsty when it comes to fuel. So let's stick with conventional rail, which works, which is reliable, which has proved to be popular. You're right about the width of the trains. Britain's trains are narrower than the ones in continental Europe, but that's not the same, and they're also not as tall as well. The bridges and the tunnels prevent us from putting...
This is path dependency, isn't it? Decisions made in the past tie your hands when you're trying to deal with the future.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, if the price of going to London on a day return was half of what it is, you get loads more people using it.
You don't need to have
gigantic... I mean, mainly it should be surely about people just being able to get around, getting backwards and forwards to work, that sort of thing. You don't need to have gigantic tracks.
There's nothing
to
wrong
do
with
that.
Subsidising things if you want to have them. Yeah. They don't all have to make a profit. That's a delusion.
I'm not going to let you get away without giving us at least in a nutshell on HS2. What do you make of it?
Okay, Rail Future as an organisation supports it because we need the capacity. I personally agree with that. We do need the capacity, but there's an awful lot wrong with it. The ridiculously high speed, the routing through the Chilterns, the lack of integration with the existing rail network. I think that I'd love them to go back to the drawing board and start again and get it right, but it's not going to happen. But I think it will happen in its existing form. And we will be able to go from London to Birmingham very fast, and no, the tickets won't cost £8 million each. But, you know, it could be better.
Okay, Steve. Bruce Williamson from Rail Futures. Thanks very much for joining us.